It's philosophy talk.
Here's all I want from you today. This is it. This is all we got to do in this conversation.
Okay.
I want you to admit that there is such a thing as white privilege. That's all I want.
I know. I knew you were going to.
Isn't white privilege just another name for racial injustice?
Isn't racial injustice just another name for white privilege?
The fact that I'm sitting here and you're sitting there is part of that white privilege.
You know, it's about role and it's about access. And what you can do is extend that privilege so that you can dismantle it.
If there were no racial discrimination or injustice, would the idea of white privilege even make sense?
It's harder if you're a ghetto kid. Yes, but can you do it? Yes.
Yes, you can. You can also win the 100-yard dash on one leg, it's harder.
Is it a privilege or a right to be treated as you deserve to be?
Our guest is Naomi Zack from the University of Oregon.
White privilege and racial injustice.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Hey, philosopher, thanks for downloading this episode of Philosophy Talk.
And thank you for being a Philosophy Talk partner.
We're grateful for your past support. We need you to stand up and help us again, now more than ever. And you can do so just by heading over to the Philosophy Talk webpage and clicking that big I Will Help button. And believe me, it will really help.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you for thinking.
And thank you for donating.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're here at the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner at Stanford. That's where Ken works. He teaches, he goes to committee meetings and all sorts of things, and I just hang around and do philosophy.
You've been doing for a long time, John. Today, we're thinking about white privilege and racial injustice.
Well, the U.S., let's admit it, it has a long and sorry history when it comes to racial injustice. It also has a long history of favoring the needs, concerns, and narratives of white people over those of people of color. But how are these two things, white privilege and racial injustice, related? That's our question for this week.
Well, so obvious, John, don't you think? I mean, just think about how many times we've had to witness the tragedy of unarmed black men and boys, little boys, getting shot and killed over practically nothing. White people just aren't subject to this kind of crap. And imagine if they were. How loud do you think the uproar would be?
Well, you get no disagreement from me on those facts, Kent, but do you have a point?
Yes, I do have a point. Eliminate white privilege, and with it the unequal treatment of whites and people of color, and racial injustice just goes away. White privilege is racial injustice.
Well, I mean, I'm just not convinced that the rampant mistreatment of blacks is an instance of, or even proof of, the existence of what you're calling white privilege.
Oh, come again?
Well, okay, we're philosophers. Let's start from the beginning. What exactly do you mean by white privilege?
I mean the fact that whites enjoy so many unearned advantages relative to others, not just in the criminal justice system, but in just about any sphere of life you can name, John.
So you think the fact that whites are much more likely to be treated with respect by cops is a sign of unearned white privilege?
Well, what did they do to deserve that privilege except be born white in a racist society? Yeah, I do.
No, they were born. Doesn't everybody, black, white, brown, anything in between, deserve to be treated with respect just because they're born?
Of course they do.
Well, then being born is all anyone ever has to do to deserve respect, so it's not a privilege, right?
Well, what are you trying to say? I'm not sure what you're trying to say.
That you're misconstruing two different things, related but different, violations of black rights and protection of white privilege.
I don't get it.
Look, I grant you that cops too often trample the right of black people. That's not to say that they don't trample the rights of whites sometimes, too, or that they often treat everybody just as they should be treated. But violations of black rights are routine and are done with far with impunity. And when whites are mistreated, there usually isn't impunity.
Well, you're just proving my point.
No, I'm refuting your point. The problem isn't that cops are wrong to respect the rights of whites. The point is they're wrong to disrespect the rights of blacks.
Wait a minute. Are you denying that there's such a thing as white privilege?
No, not at all. But I'm saying that having your rights respected is not an example of white privilege. Look, can you want to eliminate racial injustice? Don't focus on white privilege, right? Closing the country clubs won't help much. Focus on securing the too often trampled rights of people of color.
Okay, I kind of see your point. I mean, it's not like I want the cops to go around violating everybody's rights. I don't want to do that.
Yeah, no, we don't want to get equal treatment by getting everybody's rights trampled on. So I'm really glad of that, Ken.
Yeah, but look, white privilege is still a problem separate and distinct from the problem of black rights. I mean, think of that phenomenon of implicit bias, where people unconsciously judge minorities more harshly than white men. That implicit bias, I think that leads directly to white privilege.
You're talking about experiments that show implicit bias, even in people who say they aren't biased.
Yeah, yeah. Experiments where exactly the same paper is submitted to exactly the same journal, one under, say, a black-sounding name like Jamal, and one under a white male-sounding name like John. I mean, pretty reliably, John is evaluated higher than Jamal, even though it's exactly the same paper.
Yeah, but that doesn't in and of itself, eo ipso, prove the existence of white privilege. You'd have to know whether John's paper was evaluated higher than it deserved to be. That's privilege. Or Jamal's paper was evaluated lower than it should have been. That's racism.
Well, back to that same kind of riff. You're still thinking about privileges versus rights. You got to admit, I'm not really convinced. But look, I'm going to grant you something. There's a lot for us to think about here.
And to help us move the conversation forward, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Shuka Kalantari, to speak to two of her neighbors, one black, one white, about their experiences of racial injustice in Oakland, California. She files this report.
When Audrey Escoval moved to Oakland from North Carolina a few years back, one of her neighbors invited her to join a community listserv. It was a forum where people could post about neighborhood potlucks or so-called high crime alerts. It was the latter that became a problem. Some of these high crime alerts were really vague.
Vague to the point where one of the messages that caught my attention actually might have described me.
Escoval is a black woman.
So I kind of answered back and was like, well, what's criminal about this? A brown woman's walking by your house. That could be me.
So Escoval joined Neighbors for Racial Justice, a group of Oakland community members working to curb racial profiling on listservs and social media sites. But the profiling continued.
The thing that really affected me and drove me to tears was when I had posted on the website, I was making this recipe that I needed a lot of lemons for and had noticed all my neighbors had these overflowing lemon trees. And I said, hey, you know, who can spare some lemons? And this woman said, I don't care if I'm not home. She was like, there's lemons on the ground in my yard. She was like, just come and pick take as many as you want. And so I go to this woman's house and I noticed her inside and I thought, oh gosh, I've taken so many, like I should just say thank you, you know?
Escoval knocked on the door. She heard a voice on the other side say, no, absolutely not. I'm not going to open the door.
It never crossed her mind that someone that looked like me was going to show up. There's this mindset that people of color, I don't know if people think we're not of the class that can afford to live in this neighborhood or what, right? But I do. Thank you very much.
First of all, I know Audrey. And so it just hurt me that she was so dismissed, that an assumption was made about her as a dangerous person because of the color of her skin.
Ginny Burson is Audrey Escoval's neighbor and a founding member of Neighbors for Racial Justice. She's also white.
I have never been at a neighbor's house, knocked on the door and had them not answer, had them only speak to me through a closed door. That's never happened to me.
Escoval says this kind of racism is a daily occurrence in her life.
This happens all the time in the public transit system. I take BART in from Oakland over to my job here in the financial district in San Francisco.
BART is the Bay Area's transit system.
I'm usually dressed pretty nice in my corporate office outfit. This particular day, I had on my hoodie, right? And there was one seat left open right next to me. And three people got on the train. They were all appeared to be white, European, and the guy kind of motioned at the girls, like, you know, one of you take this one empty seat that's open.
The girls looked at the seat, looked at Esquivel, a black woman in a hoodie, and said no. They'd rather stand. That's never happened to Esquivel's white friend.
I don't think I've ever had an empty seat next to me on BART or on a bus or on a train and had somebody look at me and decide not to sit next to me.
Burson and Esquivel have a lot more examples of racial profiling and white privilege. At restaurants, at grocery stores, with the police. Esquivel says she meets with her neighbors every month to talk about these issues and work towards a shared goal.
Raise awareness in people's lives that when you walk down the street and you see someone who doesn't look like you, that you don't immediately assume that that person is up to some kind of suspicious or criminal behavior.
Audrey Esquivel and Ginny Burson don't think Neighbors for Racial Justice will end racism in the world, or in the U.S., or even in their community. But raising awareness about racial profiling online isn't a bad start. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Shuka Kalantari.
Thanks, Shuka, for that interesting piece about racism right here in the Bay Area and how some people are working against it. I'm John Perry. With me is my fellow Stanford philosopher, Ken Taylor.
And today, we're talking about white privilege and racial injustice. We're joined now by Naomi Zack. She's a professor of philosophy at the University of Oregon. She's author of the very fine book, White Privilege and Black Rights, The Injustice of U.S. Police Racial Profiling and Homicide. Naomi, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hi. How are you?
I'm doing all right. The concept of white privilege is used a lot these days, fairly uncritically, even by philosophers. Your book is kind of, I don't know if it's unique, but it's certainly unusual and insightful in questioning, interrogating the concept of white privilege. But what led you to take on this task?
Well, I'm sort of a philosopher nerd. And when I was watching the reports of some of the recent high-profile shootings of young black men, it occurred to me that there was a big disconnect in how well-meaning people were responding. A lot of whites were talking about white privilege. And I don't think that these cases were examples of white privilege. I think they were examples of violating black rights. In other words, I think when a 12-year-old is executed for doing nothing, that's a violation of rights. That's a palpable destruction of his life. It has nothing to do with white privilege per se.
So let's grant that distinction. But just let me ask you, Ken and I wondered whether it even makes sense to talk about white privilege. Is it a clear or concept or just worthless? Do you think there is such a thing as white privilege?
Yes, I think white privilege is real. I think given a history of slavery and Jim Crow and, the legacies of bad manners that we just heard in the earlier segment of your show, definitely what is referred to by white privilege is very real.
So what do you think?
Really
What do you think white privilege, what do you mean by white privilege then, this real thing?
Because
we're going to separate out white privilege and black rights, but what do you mean by white privilege?
All right, I would prefer to talk about white advantage. I think there are tremendous advantages in being white in a racist or even a post-racist society. A privilege is a perk. So to call it a privilege, to call these advantages privileges, makes it seem as though white people have got, in all cases, something extra just from being white. And in many of these cases, they haven't gotten anything extra. They're just being treated as human beings because they were born. I think John said that.
Okay, but no, I think there was a time. See if you agree with this. I think there was a time when America was a system of white privilege, because in that time, that's slavery, the Jim Crow era in the South. A white person had something over any white person, just in virtue of being white, had something over a black person that they at least weren't black, right? So the least of the white could claim a kind of superiority to the best among the black, because they could say to that black person,
white supremacy.
Yeah,
white supremacy.
That was a system of white supremacy,
and from the fact of white supremacy, there came certain privileges. So, you see, white supremacy is an ideology, and it was also a legal system. You know, blacks were not allowed to vote. Slaves couldn't be taught how to read and write. So, but that's an ideological system where whites are officially held up as superior. A privilege is a perk. You know, you mentioned country clubs. If you belong to the country club, you have certain privileges. You can use the tennis courts. You know, you can have private dinners in the main dining hall, whatever the perks are of belonging to the country club. But white supremacy is a lot more serious than just the fact of white privilege.
Naomi, yeah. You're making some nice distinctions. We'll have to dig more deeply into them. They're important distinctions. But right now, I'm going to remind our audience you're listening to Philosophy Talk. And today, we're thinking about white privilege and racial injustice.
Is eliminating white privilege the key to achieving racial justice? Or is it really a matter of securing the rights of blacks? Does it really matter whether we use the language of privilege or the language of rights to describe our racial situation? Can't we just try to fix it and forget about semantic debates?
Privilege, rights, and justice, plus your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
If you was white, you'd be all right. If you was brown, you'd stick around. But as you black, oh brother, get back, get back, get back.
Is it really a privilege to be white and all right, or is there a deeper wrong to right? I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Including your poetry, but not your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor, and we're thinking about white privilege and racial injustice. Is the key to achieving racial justice eliminating white privilege, or is it advancing black rights, or do those amount to the same thing?
Our guest is Naomi Zack from the University of Oregon, author of the White Privilege and Black Rights.
So, Naomi, I think we can all agree on the existence of a certain phenomenon. It's got various dimensions. Black people are often treated with less respect than white people in many contexts, have less access on average to the good things of life and all that. Everybody can agree about that phenomenon. But practically speaking, I wonder, why does it matter whether we describe this phenomenon in terms of white privilege or black rights? Why does it matter, practically speaking?
Well, it matters because there's been an erosion due to a couple or more U.S. Supreme Court rulings of constitutional rights. So the Fourth Amendment is supposed to give us all protection against unreasonable search and seizure, and the 14th Amendment is supposed to give everyone equal protection under the law. Now, these amendments seem to have been violated in these recent high-profile cases, and the violators, the killers, are not punished. You know, they're either not indicted or else they're not convicted.
Are you saying that if we – I mean, okay, that all sounds right to me, but are you saying –
That's legal.
Yeah, right. It sounds like you're suggesting, and I'm just trying to make clear whether you are or not. You sound like you're suggesting if we adopt this discourse of white privilege instead of the discourse of violations of black rights, we're going to be blind to exactly what's wrong, what's gone wrong in the situation.
That's right. You know, the problem with white privilege is not the reality that whites are better off. I mean, that is a problem, but that's not what I'm disputing. I'm just saying the discourse of white privilege, especially when white people engage in this discourse, is kind of decadent. You know what it's like? It's like foodies talking about how wonderful their meal is in response to hearing about world hunger.
Great analogy.
Well, so you're saying, gee, that sounds like a pretty darning, can I say the word damning, indictment of the discourse of white privilege. And it also sounds like you think, is it mostly white people, you think, who engage in the discourse of white privilege?
It may not be for self-serving reasons. It just may be oblivious reasons. I think one has to, at this point, be a little delicate in distinguishing who's saying what about what. And it's very different if black people talk about, see how whites are better off and talk about white privilege, than if white people, in answer to stark injustices, start talking about how privileged they are. And we're hearing a lot of that from otherwise well-meaning white people. That's what I'm trying to make a little intervention concerning.
So Naomi, philosophically speaking, from Plato's Republic to Rawls' theory of justice, philosophers who think about justice tend to go off to thinking about an ideal society. Now, I guess in an ideal society, we certainly wouldn't be trampling the rights of blacks, but we also wouldn't have at least undeserved privileges for individual whites and no privileges for people because of their race. But is focusing on an ideal society and ideal justice leading us to kind of mush two problems, one of which is much more grave and serious than the other, together?
Well, yeah. I mean, you yourself said it. If we had an ideally just society, we wouldn't have these discrepancies, but we don't. And if you actually look at real history, not the history of philosophy, but real history, people don't care about justice. What they care about is injustice. So you see that today. You know, the Black Lives Matter movement didn't come out of philosophy clubs wanting to perfect the chandelier of ideal justice hanging from the ceiling of the universe. I mean, that came from an impassioned gut reaction to blood on the street.
You have quite a way with words. I have to tell you that. I love your way with words.
No,
but I'm going to ask you a question. I'm going to ask you a question, though, about white privilege. I mean, we'll get back to the ideal versus, non-ideal justice. But I want to focus on white people just for a little bit. Because there are lots of white people who will, I don't like to generalize, but there are lots of white people who will acknowledge white privilege. And they take it to be a sign of their bona fides as an ally to marginalized people that they are willing to acknowledge their white privilege. There are others who will vehemently deny white privilege. They will turn to their own individual virtue and efforts and blah, blah, blah. So, I mean, it's a complicated thing. And I wonder... whether you think that those who deny white privilege or those who are willing to acknowledge white privilege are in any way morally different? Are they birds of a feather? Are they two sides of the same coin or what?
Well, it's political. It's political in several different levels. I mean, there are a number of whites who are pretty upset about issues of social injustice. And they'll do more than just acknowledge that they're privileged. They may actually do some research or support some causes that lead to legal reforms. And then there are whites who are sort of appalled, who are comfortable, who like to think of themselves as nice people, and they suddenly become aware that they're privileged because they're white, and their response to social injustice is to talk about how nice their privileges are. And I think that's useless. I think that energy could be much better directed. And then in political terms, there are a number of whites who are undereducated, who believe that all of the ills that befall minorities are their own fault. And therefore, they, in contrast, as hardworking white people, deserve all of the good things that happen to them. And they have no privileges, that this is just like a slick con on the created by the chattering classes to pull the wool over everybody's eyes. There are no privileges. They actually think that the tide has turned and it's really black people who have all the privileges now. So that's the political, you know, this last thing is an issue of political rhetoric and undereducation. I don't know too much that can be said about that, except, you know, if you can come up with a few good one-liners here and there, maybe that works.
Well, look, I pretty much agree with you, but it does seem to me there's one case where the concept of white privilege might be useful. I mean, it has to do with that third group you were talking about, probably. In U.S. universities, particularly Ivy League universities and private universities, the concept of white privilege has been used to call attention to some kids of privilege that not about facts about society, but about their own internal conception. They're acting as if they had white privilege or often male privilege. So for that purpose, it seems to me it's a useful concept. Don't you agree?
Well, I'd like to finesse it a little bit. You mean white undergraduates who are racist, who think they're entitled to certain kinds of benefits because they're white? Is that what you're talking about?
Well, I think talking about the first step in getting undergraduates who probably don't think they're racist to realize that that they may be, because they're not just getting white privileges. They're kind of expecting it. And, then the next step is to say, why do you expect it? Yeah.
Yeah. No, obviously. You know, these things operate on many levels, and people have different degrees of awareness. And what I'm rather narrowly talking about is that when we have egregious incidents of rights violations, rights to privacy and protection of one's person, and actually death by police with no probable cause violates the right against unreasonable seizure, rights to equal protection under the law, regardless of race, creed, religion, and so forth. And we're talking about these issues. The discourse of white privilege does not get us very far.
I get you, and I just want to add one thought that I'm thinking now for the first time listening to you. I think the discourse of rights has a universalistic appeal, and we agree that we have the rights. Our Constitution enshrines the right to protection from unreasonable search and seizure. It doesn't say black people have it, white people. The white privilege is this highly contestable discourse, because you outlined some of the ways in which people contest it. Right? And there are people who deny that they have it, people who assert it but then don't do anything about it, people who, you know, for all kinds of reasons.
Right.
It's a place of contestation in a way that seems to me that fundamental basic rights are not. And talk of fundamental basic rights has a kind of automatic call to action on all of us. So it seems a more practical, useful, action-oriented.
It's a very good point that there's unity in talking about basic human rights. However, rights can sometimes just be unrealistic posits. I mean, what you need for rights to be real is they have to be protected in legal jurisdictions. They have to be written into constitutions. They have to be upheld in the courts, and they have to be implemented by police and other officials. And what's happened with the Fourth and 14th Amendment rights in a few Supreme Court cases in past decades is that when it comes to encounters with police, they have been struck down. It has been decided that they're irrelevant. So, for example, in Graham, I don't want to bore you or your listeners by talking about specific legal cases, and I'm not a legal scholar, but the bottom line is that the standard is not whether or not a Fourth or a 14th Amendment right has been violated. The standard is whether or not the officer could say that he was afraid.
Yeah. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about white privilege and racial injustice. And we've got a caller, Mika from San Francisco. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Mika.
Hi, good morning. I think that your discussion of white privilege is screaming for context, universal context and historical context.
Okay.
The fact is that everywhere in the world, some society is privileged. In Africa, blacks are privileged. In China and Japan, white people are discriminated against. In my field of work, I applied for grants, and if I was a person of color, I would have had a much better chance of getting my grants accepted. So, and all throughout history, since the dawn of time, whenever you have a group of people getting together, some of them become privileged. So if you want to talk about how to eliminate privilege, we have to first discuss, how is it serving human beings? Why is it part of human nature to have some people become privileged?
So thank you for the comment, Mika. Naomi, you want to respond to that in any way?
Well, I think it's true in a general sense. I mean, we have hierarchies in human society, but again, when we're talking about basic human rights, the right to safety, the right to equal treatment under the law, that is not negotiable as a matter of privilege. unless you accept the fact that we all live in a terribly oppressive totalitarian system and anybody can be killed at any time for no reason, then those who get off, those who escape, could be called privileged. If that's how you want to talk, fine. But otherwise, we have to distinguish between pervasive human hierarchies, which are real, and basic human rights.
Michael from Boston's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Michael.
Yes, hello. I think the elimination of privilege, in this case white privilege, is a prerequisite to the rule of general law, because it doesn't matter how the laws are written if they're only enforced for one group or if they're enforced favorably for a group. I'll give a concrete example and one you might use with college students. I went to a small technical school in Pasadena, and out of about 850 people there, I would say there were probably around 500 drug users, illegal drug users, maybe 400. And over the course of 4 years there, I didn't know any of them who were arrested.
Yeah, so thanks.
And if they had been arrested, I'm pretty sure none of them would have met with an unfortunate accident in jail. So it doesn't matter that the laws made it illegal for everyone. The fact is that privilege, that is private law, made it such that they didn't have to worry about it. And the final thing I think we could say that might be more popular, because, you know, every white person who's not a success can see in the media 10 black people doing better than they are. If you can say, we want everyone to be treated as well as a rich white man, people may be afraid that if they lose their privilege, they'll be treated as badly as a poor black woman.
Thanks a lot for the call, Michael. What's your we're about to go to a break, so what's your brief comment there, Naomi?
Well, there's no such thing as private law. You know, when we're talking about law, it's not just a question of what's written. It's a question of how it's enforced and how it's implemented and how it's interpreted by the courts. And people need to take a closer look at those three things.
But I think he was confused on the point you're making, but we'll get to that. Because I think that if you respected everybody's rights equally, this apparent privilege would just go away. So it's a problem about disrespect for rights. But, you know, you're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're thinking about white privilege and black rights with Naomi Zack from the University of Oregon.
In our final segment, we'll try to work towards getting some practical prescriptions for achieving racial justice soon in our troubled society.
Justice for all, black, white, or brown, when Philosophy Talk continues.
Beyonce and a song called Formation, which she sang at the Super Bowl. According to Saturday Night Live, white people all over America were shocked to find out that Beyonce was black, or at any rate, a person of color. Some people thought the performance was too focused on race and identity politics. Would a white singer have the privilege of avoiding that kind of criticism? I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Naomi Zack from the University of Oregon, and we're thinking about white privilege and black rights.
So, Naomi, we want to get a little bit practical here, but let me give you a kind of a different example than the sort we've been using. I'm kind of old, and my studliness, let's say, if it ever existed, is long in the past. If I try to go to a hot club, I'll be turned down by the guy at the door. I'll feel bad about that. I'll think young people have all these privileges. They can read stuff in 9-point fonts. They can go to good clubs. But then if I'm beat up by the police for complaining, I would feel a much more serious problem was there. You know, my rights had been violated, whereas in the earlier case, maybe just there was kind of an unfairness involved, a little less serious. Now, how should philosophers think about these things? If we're not going to just do this kind of let's figure out the ideal society, but let's figure out the basis for the difference, for the distinctions we made, for things that are outrageous violations of justice and things that are just kind of sad facts about our society, how should we get started doing that?
Well, I think there's a priority for egregious violations of justice. If you're looking at the whole social political picture. On the other hand, if you're a specialist in social philosophy and media studies, you might not care that much, and that's fine. That's just not what you're working on. But if you're looking at the society, if you're looking at what's happening in contemporary times, I think we have certain things that need to come first.
So as a practical example, a lot of people think about how do you think of affirmative action in this context of privilege versus violation of rights?
Right. Some people would think of affirmative actions as breaking down barriers of white privilege, right? Rather than, I mean, nobody has a right to be admitted to. So it's not that people's rights are being violated, but certain structures of privilege are being broken down.
Yeah, affirmative action is interesting in that case. I think that one of the results of white advantage, you could call it white privilege, is that if people are in a position of power, they're going to use it for people they know. So if you can admit students or hire other faculty, you're going to go to people like you, to children of friends, to people you already know. And if you're white, it's likely to be other white people. Affirmative action, and that's called cronyism. Now, affirmative action is a way of breaking into that and creating more opportunities. It's not just creating opportunities for people of color or for women. It's creating opportunities in the structure. It's angling into that structure of cronyism, which is lined up with white privilege.
Is that improving justice? That is, cronyism is anti-justice. This is a kind of distributional thing, cronyism, right? Who do I distribute this club memberships to?
Right.
And that sounds unjust. So it sounds like even though you think a kind of justice is better served by the language of pursuit of a kind of justice is better served by adopting the language of rights and protecting rights, this is a sphere of justice in which breaking down systems of privilege, breaking down these distributional systems, is also a part of justice. Is that right?
Well, there are different forms of justice. There's immediate justice. You do not want the police to be able to come up to you or your children and shoot them on sight. That's extremely unjust. I mean, that's an emergency situation of injustice. But, you know, there are wider structural forms of social justice. If we're to have a democracy, if we're to continue to work on having a democracy, you want everybody to have a reasonable opportunity for the goods of life. And one of the ways that that can happen is to break into systems that are closed because of tradition or because of racial hierarchy. And affirmative action is a way of doing that.
Okay, that's good. Charles from Montclair is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Charles.
Yes, I have a different take on this. And I think it's more a matter of class, that if you are rich in America or part of the establishment, regardless of color, you get treated differently than if you're a poor white or black or poor anything, or even the middle class. And to give you an illustration, our former president, George W. Bush, got into Harvard Business School, notoriously difficult to get into, as he proudly announced he was a C student at Yale. Now, you know, could I do this? Could you do this?
Well,
and the same thing, you take General Petraeus.
I might have been able to earn a C at Yale.
Yes, well, I could have too, but I only managed to do that in Berkeley.
Yeah, but that was a long time ago. It would be pretty hard to replicate George Bush's success. Don't advise young people coming up to rely on family connections to get them into Yale or Harvard. It doesn't work.
Let me give you a different example. General Petraeus, you know, he was caught handing his mistress secrets. And so he pays a $100,000 fine, and now he's employed, being the establishment by Goldman Sachs, making a lavish salary. Whereas the whistleblower, Assange, whoever it was, is being pursued ruthlessly for the rest of his life by our fine government. Now, is that not a difference?
Thanks for the comment, Charles. I'm going to turn this over and ask Naomi what she thinks.
Well, I think class will only get you so far, and then you run into issues of status. For example, Henry Louis Gates was an African-American professor at Harvard. Had that incident a few years ago where he was stopped after returning, trying to get into his own house. He was got into an altercation with police, was arrested. President Obama has been treated with incredible disrespect, which after a while one can only conclude has a racial component. It's not class. So yeah, sure, class, and you know, class is not one monolithic matter of income. I mean, it has to do with culture. It has to do with networks of social capital, education, and money. And class is important, but it's not the whole story because there have been studies on every level of class. Whites are better off than blacks. Yeah, so on every socioeconomic, yeah.
I want to take you back to a distinction you made at the top that I like, but I want to interrogate it a little more. You distinguish white privilege as a system of perks from white supremacy as an ideology and all that.
Right.
And I get your distinction. I think it's an important distinction. But I want to push you a little bit because I was recently reading some stuff of Cornel West, and he diagnoses the problem with President Obama by saying President Obama refuses to address the fact. He's too afraid to address the fact that the U.S. is still a white supremacist society. It's not legally so. I mean, the laws aren't the same. But the root problem in the U.S. is white supremacy. And you, if you look at it critically, he thinks you see it everywhere. Now, why do you think Cornel West is? I assume you think Cornel West is wrong. Why do you think he's wrong? I like your distinction, but tell me why you're right and he's wrong.
I think Cornel West is great rhetorician. Okay, so in general, especially when bad things happen, from the standpoint of people of color, it feels like the word philosophers like to use is phenomenology. Phenomenologically, it's a white supremacist society. But it's very important to realize it's not a white supremacist system because people of color can vote. Discrimination in education is against the law. Discrimination in housing, even though we have the highest rate of residential segregation since about 1970, despite that, discrimination is illegal. So you have formal equality. And as Descartes would have said, that's not nothing.
But you make a distinction between, like, the formal law, you yourself, and the formal rights and material rights, I think you call it
right.
In your book.
That's right.
Somebody like West would say, well, formally you're right, Naomi, but materially, right. Materially it's still these structures of white
yeah.
privilege are the material right. implementation without formal white supremacy of a kind
yeah.
of white supremacy.
Okay, so more work needs to be done. It would be a very naive view of law and society to think that all you had to do was pass a few pieces of legislation and that formal equality would result in real material equality. There's more work that has to be done. And to just rest and say, well, we have a white supremacist system and the president should do, well, what do you want the president to do?
Yeah, I kind of tend to agree. I mean, with all due respect to Cornel West, I don't think whatever misapprehension of the racial situation Obama might have is his problem. I think his problem is basically Republicans, and in particular the gerrymandering that means they have a majority in the House even though they got less votes than the Democrats.
But there's something you said that was, I think, really striking, and I really want to think about it. I mean, we only got a little minute, but you talked about phenomenologically. So I'm thinking, okay, as an oppressed black person, if I felt myself to be that, right?
Right.
Phenomenologically, can I distinguish phenomenologically in my own experience from a structure of white privilege from a white supremacist society? I mean, how would I distinguish that phenomenologically?
Yeah, well, look, it might feel the same. Emotionally, it might feel the same. Spiritually, it might feel the same. But if you want to do something, it's not the same. Because if you want to do something, things can be done in the present situation. Do you think that a movement called Black Lives Matter could have arisen and survived under Jim Crow?
Yeah, I see your point. I see your point. And this is, you know what? We're just getting to something really good. I really wish we had like another half an hour, because I really want to dig into what you just said. And I want to dig into the phenomenology of the black activist in this kind of situation. But unfortunately, we're at the end of the hour, and I'm going to have to thank you for joining us. It's been a fascinating conversation, Naomi.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
Our guest has been Naomi Zack. She's a professor of philosophy at the University of Oregon. She's author of White Privilege and Black Rights, The Injustice of U.S. Police Racial Profiling and Homicide. So, John, are you ready to check your white privilege yet?
Well, sure. I must admit, when I first started working on this show, it seemed to me a pretty subtle distinction that Naomi was making. But as I read her book and some other things and listened to her talk, I think she's on to a really important distinction that will help clarify things, and in particular, help clarify what we ought to be focusing on with what degree of urgency.
Yeah, I agree with you, and I only wish her book is kind of short. It's a good read. You should read it. The only thing I wish it was longer in a certain way.
Well, there's a longer one on the way.
Yeah, I know, because the white privilege side needs more thought, and the black rights side needs more thought. But you know what? This is a start, and this conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner, at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is cogito ergo blogo. I think, therefore I blog. And you too can become a partner in that community just by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
Now let's hear from a privileged white guy that also happens to have an incredible talent for talking fast. Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, white privilege is one of those monolithic mythical things like political incorrectness that can get me in trouble culturally, whether I'm guilty of it or not. If I insist on a point, well, that's my white privilege. But if I let a point go, I'm a wuss who does not stand up for what I believe in. A perk of being a white man in the U.S. is if I venture a strong opinion, which I've been known to do from time to time, I am considered neither a representative of white people nor a betrayer of white people, just another white guy with a big mouth. I don't have to worry about ethnic ramifications, just personal ones. On the other hand, though, any strong opinion I may utter may be considered an example of white privilege. Because my opinion assumes a position in society that not only enables me to have a strong opinion, it dictates to me, culturally, what that opinion should be. In other words, a white guy with an opinion in today's world is either an ignorant blowhard or a blowhard mouthing received information. These two attitudes seem to be two ways of not having one's cake and not getting to eat it either, unless you're Donald Trump. In which case, you get to ride the bloated horse of angry grievance into the sunset. Well, we'll see. A study last fall out of Princeton revealed that white privilege, real or not, is in trouble. Rising death rates in the white middle class are not coming from heart disease and diabetes, but from an epidemic of suicides and overdoses of heroin and prescription drugs and from alcoholic liver disease. Bill Clinton, campaigning for his wife, has picked up on this study in speeches. He attributed anger in the electorate to anxiety over changing demographics. He told a group of pharmacists in Las Vegas on December 3rd that middle-aged, middle-class white Americans are, quote, dying of a broken heart, unquote, which makes the white middle class seem like a high school girl dumped at the prom. Some claim that the popularity of Donald Trump is due largely to support from angry white men. As an angry white guy myself, or at least a grumpy one, I don't quite see the logic here. He is clearly a bad boyfriend from any angle. If he's elected president, that won't translate into jobs for white guys. If you open a new resort, maybe we'd get jobs as dealers or greenskeepers or bouncers until they crunch the numbers, shut the casino down, and declare bankruptcy the way he does. But if he's president, that's not going to happen. And who is to blame for the old white guy's broken heart? Legal immigrants taking all the jobs. India taking the job you used to have and doing it for a dollar overseas, am I right? Black people on all the welfare, spending your tax dollars on bad wine and crack. The wife leaving you, taking the kids with her, the bank foreclosing, the finance company taking the car. Now they're trying to get you to vote for minimum wage. Isn't that why the Walmarts are shutting down? Once you pay people enough money to live on, that's the end of capitalism and the end of the white middle class. Still, it seems when it comes to elections, the vanishing white middle class remains the electorate of our dreams, the cash cow of Smallville, the golden geese that keeps laying golden eggs, the Elvis of demographics. Once again, the poor saps keep hoping, I guess, that white privilege is a real thing and will actually get them something. I can only hope that this delusion will pass, along with racism itself, and 30 years from now, the rainbow people of tomorrow will all be living together in peace and harmony in Trump Towers in Trumpville, the new capital of Trumpsylvania. We better hope we'll be living there. If we're not, well, we'll be shot on sight. That's just the way it is. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2016.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
The program is produced by Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Dave Millar is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Merle Kessler, Mark Stone, Erica Topete, and Ted Muldoon.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and the partners at our online community of thinkers.
And from the members of KALW San Francisco, local public radio, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you, too, can become a partner in our community of thinkers.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
It's hard enough just to walk through life decent as a person. But here's another element added to it when you're black. Your mama's got that little edge on us. It's enough to make you crazy.